afternoon and welcome. I'm Lawrence McDonald, Vice President for Communication and Policy Outreach at the Center for Global Development, and you have made an absolutely great choice to be here today because we are not only launching this book, we're in fact launching a new approach to the delivery of foreign aid, cash on delivery aid, which we'll hear more about momentarily. But before you do, I wanted to plant the idea that new ways of delivering foreign aid are not necessarily pie in the sky. Sometimes when we hear about new plans, we think, well, that could be nice if only it would happen. But I was thinking back on really the history of foreign aid, and it has changed over time and continues to change. Some of this is about interest in different sectors. In the 50s and 60s, the focus on infrastructure, which may be coming back now, then the interest in policy and so-called adjustment lending, the past decade with the huge funding and interest in global health, more recently a push that my center has been part of to focus more explicitly on the needs of girls and women, and especially adolescent girls. We've also seen changes in modality, the rise of budget support funding, the huge amount of money and interest in microfinance, various new ways come and go. Some of them are definitely improvements, maybe not all. Our goal today is to persuade you that cash on delivery aid would indeed be a significant improvement for at least a small portion of the $100 billion plus that we spend on foreign assistance each year, for a lot of interesting reasons that have not primarily to do with the people who are providing the money, but rather with the beneficiaries. We will hear first from three of the authors. Nancy Birdsall will speak about how she became interested in this idea and the principles of cash on delivery aid. Aya Mahboob will talk about its application in the particular sector that we've explored most closely, to primary schooling. And Bill Savidoff will talk about the application to some of the other sectors and possible steps forward. I'll then introduce our esteemed panel. We'll have a bit of discussion and then open it to those of you here in the room. Whether or not this thing becomes a reality depends a lot on what you decide here today. So I know you'll be listening carefully. The people in this room have the ability to drive this forward. Thank you for coming. Nancy, over to you.
Thank you very much, Lawrence. It's really nice to see a lot of friends in the audience. Many people who know how obsessed I am with cash on delivery aid, how excited I've gotten over the last few years thinking about it. I got started on thinking about this issue in part because I did a paper for a major conference in Bangladesh that ended up being called Seven Deadly Sins, Reflections on Donor Failings. And behind that paper was, for me, the idea that aid can be made to work. It often does work, but too often it doesn't work, especially where it's needed most. And that the aid system sometimes is cutting off its own nose to spite its face. The aid system, private and public, is part of the problem. Of course, the official donors, for more than 10 years, have been resolving to fix the aid system. There's the Paris Declaration, the Accra follow-up, a lot of good talk, sensible talk about ownership, alignment, participation, and so on. But there hasn't really been that much progress in making a difference in how aid is delivered. What's the fundamental problem? I think part of it is that it's just difficult, we have to recognize that, to do transfers from outside to any government or unit of government. It's as difficult for the U.S. federal system to make transfers to the states and be sure and be comfortable about what will happen as it is, in a way, for the donor system to make transfers to poor countries. So what's the fundamental problem? I like to think of it by turning around the usual Boston Tea Party slogan, which was no taxation without representation. And think instead, can there be representation without taxation? The fundamental problem in many low-income countries because they're highly dependent on, as much as 50% of their spending comes from outside, they're highly dependent on aid, is that their tax system, as part of their social contract, is not yet activated. It's not yet working. The problem is always there when the money is coming from outside. This is the fundamental problem of incentives and accountability that we're trying to address with this particular modality we've defined of cash on delivery aid. Let me just say a few quick words about the fundamental features of cash on delivery aid, and then my colleagues will follow up. There are five. First, well, let me say, think of it as a business-like contract. That's what we're proposing, between one or more funders and one or more recipient governments. Think of it as a five-year contract. We also propose that to address one of the sins that I outlined in that earlier paper, the impatience of the donors. They want results now. A business-like contract could be with private or public money that has these five features. First, outcomes, not inputs. The outcomes would measure incremental progress on some fundamental goal that is a goal both of the funder and the recipient. Second, hands-off on the part of the funder. It's not the funder that would design the inputs. The funder has agreed on the outcomes. It's the government that worries about what economists call the production function, the inputs, and has 5 years in principle to try different interventions, learn from them, and possibly adjust. Third, independent verification, so that the funder can be comfortable that the money being transferred is covering the actual outcomes or is associated with outcomes and is not being lost, say, to waste, corruption, and so on. That was third. Fourth, transparency to the citizens so that there's a partial substitute for the absence of the tax system in full regalia that creates accountability. There's accountability to citizens. This is a way through transparency to make sure, you'll hear more about it, I shouldn't say too much more. That's fourth. And fifth, complementary to other aid, to the upfront input type aid that is traditional. Complementary in the sense that it might, by bringing incentives and greater accountability, actually increase the efficiency with which all the other aid is used. Over to you, Aya. Thank you, Nancy. So Nancy just described the general features of the approach to you, and I'll explain how it can work in practice. In the book, we describe in great detail how the approach can be applied to a universal goal shared by funders and recipients alike, which is that every student complete primary school. The way that this approach would work for primary school is that funders would enter into an agreement to pay, for example, $200 for every additional child that reaches the final year of primary school and takes an assessment exam. And the funder would commit to pay that funding proportional to progress, regardless of the scores that the students achieve on these exams. The funder and the recipient would sign a contract that would outline the outcome indicator, the verification mechanisms that would be in place, and the transparency of the contract. But beyond that, the funders would not engage substantively with the government unless the government requested technical assistance from the funders. Funders would also contract a verifying agent to verify that the report that the government issued of progress payment was accurate. At that time, the funder would then make payments proportional to the progress that had been verified. The government, which would receive this cash on delivery funding, would be able to use this funding for anything that it chooses. So this might be within the purview of the Ministry of Education, but it might also be under the purview of the Ministry of Infrastructure, where they may decide to use the funding to pay roads to get children to school, or the Ministry of Health to pay for health programs to ensure that children are healthy and remaining at school. After developing this proposal, we spent time in a few independent countries to see whether this approach could work in practice. One country visited was Malawi. And in Malawi, we had a chance to visit a primary school to get a sense of the constraints on the ground. And at the school, as many of you may know from doing education work, there were no desks, no chairs, no books for the students to read from, no latrines for them to use, the roofs had holes in them, so during the rainy season, students would have to take their courses outside under a tree. And in the first years of primary school, in that school, there were almost 200 students for every teacher. But by the final year, there were only about 20 students. So how could casual delivery aid make a difference in a country like Malawi? It could help align incentives across the government and across funders to focus on the outcome that really matters, which is for children to finish primary school. And now Bill will speak about the application of the approach to other sectors.
Thanks, Aya. As Aya covered the education proposals detailed in the book, and we went through that to show that the CODA concept as a general concept can actually be practical, can be implemented. And you can imagine a CODA agreement being in place and at the end of the day responding to the accountability mechanisms that Nancy was mentioning too, so that the funder can say, we paid $200 for each child who completed school, whatever that number was. And the people in the country can say, our government did, or in the case it didn't, didn't educate these children or did educate these children, even though this money was available. So that level of transparency in the agreement becomes very important to changing the dynamics of accountability from the way most aid is given today. Now, the CODA concept is a general idea that we're putting out there, and it can be applied to other sectors. The book describes a number of them, and we're specifically looking in more detail at the health and the water sectors right now. And each time we enter, look at a CODA, if it could resolve some of the problems in a new sector, a number of concerns get raised, reasonable concerns, about why it might or might not work. One of the biggest ones that comes up over and over again is that you can end up having unintended consequences. Putting a financial incentive on something like a single indicator is a very high-powered incentive relative to other things. In education, the issue that came up almost immediately was, are you going to end up sacrificing quality at the expense of quantity? And that's why the indicator that's designed includes testing and publication of test scores as a way of trying to create a check on the quality of the education that the children are getting. In the water sector, we might have an indicator that's rewarding consumption of water, but then would you end up rewarding excess consumption or waste, and that wouldn't be good. So you need to think about the indicators intelligently and come up with something that addresses these kinds of concerns. Another concern that comes up is whether the outcomes are measurable at all and can be verified. So in the case of education, when we started with the idea of paying for kids who complete primary school, we found out the definition of what it means to complete primary school isn't actually very clear. And moving toward a discussion with education experts toward the idea of paying against each child who reaches the final year of school and takes a test, that is a clear indicator. It's relevant to the goal, and it is verified. In health, for example, we're looking at things like, is it better to pay against reductions in child mortality, which might be very difficult to measure compared to a sample of children in terms of height for age or some other measure. So these are the kinds of things that you can solve sector by sector once you start looking at the specific conditions. Other concerns have been raised about whether this would be subject to waste and corruption, how it would work in fragile states, what happens in countries that have particularly weak capacity. The book goes through these various concerns, how we think they can be addressed, and also, in other cases, just noting that these may be problems for CODA, but there's certainly problems for existing modalities as well. And so the counterfactual is whether the question is whether this modality might perform better than an existing one. One general concern that I do want to talk about in some detail that comes up often is how this shifts risk onto the recipient. And the and it actually doesn't shift the risk onto the recipient the way most people think about it, because of the current risks of aid, which is highly volatile, are based on things that are outside of the recipient's control. When a recipient has an aid program signed with a funder, they're subject to all kinds of policy shifts. They're subject to whims and changes in personnel. They have uncertainty about whether waivers will be granted on certain conditions. And by contrast, with CODA, the contract's set based on the outcome of the service delivery. And those functions are things that are much closer into the control of the government, whether kids are getting through school or not, than the changing geopolitical concerns of a funder. So as we tried to move into making this happen, we started talking to funders in countries, we found that most of the obstacles to moving ahead with CODA are actually on the funder side. A simple example was talking to aid agency staff in countries who would maybe resistant to the idea. They start getting an understanding of it. They think it's nice. They'd like to try it. But their funds are fully programmed, and they don't know where they would get the money for it, or they would take an enormous risk in doing a CODA program compared to doing business as usual as they have in the past. A lot of times the funders will say, well, it's a great idea, but how can we be sure that the country will succeed? And that's just undermining the idea that the country has to have ownership. It has to have its own responsibility and ownership of these programs. And it sort of shows that the pressure to disperse in funding agencies is much larger than the pressure to achieve results. And that's what the CODA concept is really trying to revert. We're not saying it's easy for a funder to adopt this, but if a funder does embrace the idea, it will, we believe, fundamentally change that dynamic towards real outcomes-based, hands-off modality. So we have no illusions that this is going to solve every problem. We think it's promising enough that it's worth trying. We insist that there should be parallel research to assess whether it's working or how it's functioning, and give it a try. And in the CGD tradition of moving ideas to action, we're working on a number of, we're discussing with funders in a variety of countries about the possibility of implementing the education proposal that's detailed in the book, and talking with others about the possibility of applying it to health and water, as I mentioned before. So if you'd like to follow the initiative, please go to our website, sign up for the CGD CODA newsletter. And but for today, we're looking forward to hearing the panel's thoughts about the idea and to your reactions. And I just challenge you to sort of make the leap, think, if there were such an outcomes-based, hands-off agreement for some high-level indicator in your country or the sector that you're working in, how might it change the dynamics relative to the current way of doing it? Thank you.
While the panel is taking their seats, I draw your attention to the back of the book, which has term sheets in it. And in the tradition of the advanced market commitment work that we did, we not only outlined the idea, or I should say the authors have not only outlined the idea, but provided some of the language that would be used in drafting such a contract. So this book is somewhere in between being a conceptual presentation of an idea and a bit of a handbook as to how to proceed. It's now my pleasure to introduce our panelists, starting to my left. Mauro DeLorenzo is Vice President for Freedom and Free Enterprise at the John Templeton Foundation. He's also a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Michael Kramer is the Gates Professor of Developing Societies at Harvard University, a senior fellow at Brookings, and I'm also proud to say non-resident fellow here at the Center for Global Development. His many publications include Strong Medicine, Creating Incentives for Pharmaceutical Research on Neglected Diseases. And Michael, you're also a co-chair of the Advanced Market Commitment Working Group that the center organized. It has led, by the way, to a $1.5 million advanced market commitment. Another one of those ideas that looked a bit pie in the sky initially and has actually now come to pass. Billion, I meant to say. Did I say billion? Billion with a B, for pneumococcal disease, which annually kills 3 million children in the developing world. Rakesh Rajani is the founder and head of Toeza, which is a new 10-year initiative, I guess it's going to be 10 years after it's been running for 10 years, to enhance access to information, citizen agency, and public accountability in East Africa. And I had the privilege of joining other members of the center for breakfast with Rakesh yesterday, and he was telling us about some of his investigations, I guess primarily in Tanzania, but elsewhere in East Africa, of the variety of things, but including the differences between the reported statistics on school enrollment and what's going on in the schools when you show up unannounced. And so, Rakesh, I want to actually start with you. If you can tell us a bit about that and whether or not you think that COD aid might be part of the solution for that and how. But first, what did you find when you visited the schools?
Thank you. The official story is everything's going well. Enrollments are up 97-98%. Even school completion is up in that more kids are finishing school. And so everything sounds rosy, and Tanzania is praised for being close to achieving the Millennium Development Goal on education. But when you actually visit the schools and try to see what's going on, if you talk to the teachers, if you observe what's going on, if you do a simple test with the children, you realize that you have millions of children who are attending or who are on a list in the primary school who are enrolled, but in fact they are not learning. So this is a real crisis now, and thanks to media, thanks to radio and television and newspapers and people being able to send SMS messages to each other. This crisis is now much more important. So Tanzania as a society knows we need to figure it out, but we don't know quite what to do, and I hope that COD might be an experiment.
Thanks very much. Mauro, one of your research interests I noticed on your AEI bio is how to improve democratic accountability in developing countries. I wonder, based on your previous work on that, if you have any thoughts about whether this can be a help or not, or if there are risks that you see. I think we'd be interested in hearing those as well.
I don't know, but I don't know of another big idea in development which is more likely to produce some advances in the I mean, the first pages of this book were a big lesson for me because I've struggled trying to figure out how you articulate and look at all these different strands of the PDA effectiveness debate. And I think you've tried to answer exactly the right question or the right problem, which is the political one. How do you raise money in one jurisdiction, in one political space, and spend it in another, and have accountability over how that money is spent? We have lots of different techniques and technologies to try and manage that, audits, participatory efforts to develop things. None of them work very well, and they're all, in some sense, a substitute effort to compensate for the fact that you're spending someone else's money. Disconnect, I think, is where you're tackling it head on. Whether the people whose money it is here are going to feel as though, you're assuming, first of all, that there is a constituency for effective aid in donor nations, and I think there's a lot of reasons to be suspicious or skeptical about that. People have pointed that out for a long time. You point out in this work how many different purposes there are. There's probably a good reason why there aren't a lot of hearings in Congress about whether the aid that was spent actually worked and had good results. Again, I think all of us who are in the development land just assume that anyone this money is obviously being spent to have an effect. I think your model is likely to increase the likelihood that it'll have an effect. The question is whether anyone cares enough to take on the additional risks that the model entails. You're paying cash on delivery for a result. That money can be then spent or used in any number of ways, some of which could be embarrassing or risky for the donor. A few scandals might cause people to review whether the model works. And if a lot of other ones that might be moving. One that comes to mind first, there's education and there's health. You make the important connection between representation and taxation. Why couldn't there be cash on delivery for improvements in tax collection? Have a matching program for tax collection. I noticed in the MCC process and in the administration, a real focus when it came time for this administration to figure out how to sell to Congress in the middle of a major budget crisis, increased aid efforts, a real focus on how much money are these countries raising themselves. How can I go to Congress and ask for $2 billion extra dollars for country acts when they're only collecting 3% of their GDP in taxation. There aren't very good indicators on that, and there's not a lot of pressure for GDP. Could this be something that could incentivize it?
The
the Indonesian government with support from the World Bank has been trying something like this.
Is you want to encourage country ownership, and so you have people in the country saying, would you please take the flags off of stuff? We're the ones who are doing this work. And it just seemed to me that one of the advantages of this is that the donor can then say, you know, we paid for 10,000 more kids to graduate from school, but at the same time you're backing way off in terms of how that should happen. And so I'd like to hear from each of you if you think that that's a useful attribute, if it's a good sales point in talking to donor countries. If you think the whole thing doesn't make sense, maybe it's not a problem, but respond to that notion that, that this makes this a useful way to incentivize donors in the rich world and still keep them kind of out of the business of figuring out what to do in the developing country. Anybody who wants to go first is welcome. Mike?
I think this is politically brilliant. And I may not mean much, but what this really reminds me of in a certain way is progressive initial cash transfers. So Mexico had a system, sort of a patchwork system of very interventionist, we're going to provide this type of assistance for health and this for education. And, economists have pushed for a long time for, look, let's just have a negative income tax and just redistribute a lot of money to poor people. And that doesn't get a lot of support. It doesn't get a lot of support in the U.S., maybe in Europe or something. But, in the U.S., it doesn't get a lot of support. And then in Mexico and Latin America, this was a hard sell. And what progressive did was it fundamentally you know, people don't, I think they have a moral and ethical objection, which economists don't understand or appreciate. They're just giving something for nothing. And what Progressive did was, part of what it did is it reframed the whole discussion, which is, we're going to give cash to these poor families, but in exchange for something, which is in exchange for making sure that their kids are in school or are getting the basic health care. And I think if you think about, you know, if you think about the larger aid debate, European governments have signed up for things like budget support, but the U.S. hasn't, and it's just not really consistent with American values to say, we're going to hand over a bunch of money to the government of Tanzania to, you know, do what they think, what they want to. I mean, that's not, Americans are just not, so they, even with, you know, with any government, we don't like government that much, we don't like redistribution that much. But if this offers the possibility to reframe it exactly as you said, which is something that I think most Americans would support, which is kids in Tanzania should have the opportunity to go to primary school. And if Tanzania achieves this, then they're going to get paid for results. I think that's potentially a right way to do it.
Jason Martin, what do you want to
close it? I agree with that. I think there's differences between the United States and Europe on this question. I don't think they're ever going to get Congress to make bounty payments to foreign governments. In this way, no matter how good the mechanism is, to get American money into it, I think you'd need to have almost some kind of intermediary system, like the Global Fund, which would take American money from.
You're talking about budget support or cash on delivery? Yeah?
Cash on delivery.
I see.
Cash on delivery.
So you see that as being a political problem in the U.S.?
Yeah. I think, yeah.
Maybe explain that more.
Well, we do this in our own country, we don't. The idea that you're going to pay bureaucrats in a foreign state, they're the ones who are going to get a reward for kids going to school, and not, for example, that school itself. Right? Look how in this country we design the No Child Left Behind and similar things. It's the schools get some of the benefit, not the Ministry of Education or the State Department of Education. You know, is the unit the right one? I think a lot of people in the United States would have a lot of trouble with that. I also don't think there's anything in your model which requires it to be about central government. In my new role as a grant maker for a foundation, found lots of things which I'm going to try and experiment with some of our grantees. It's a powerful way of conceptualizing relationships and accountability. There's nothing, you could do it for local governments, right? So you have to find the unit which cares about results, which cares about the performance, whether it's both in the donor country or simply one. It may not be the people in the Ministry of Education, it may be district officials. And that's where the payments should end up. It may be the right way for private philanthropists to organize some of their giving. Whether it's to the central government or to individual things. Why shouldn't the heads of private schools, right? There's a lot of educational opportunities in poor countries are private and they're for-profit. Some of you may be familiar with the work of James Dooley. The FCA is getting more interested in this. Just like they found on how 50% of the healthcare consumed in Africa is supplied privately. None of that is able to be accounted for in this model, not because there's anything wrong with the model, but because it wasn't the problem we're trying to solve, but I think developing things which can make improvements in these other ones too. I also wonder if there's, whether you actually need the contract at all. There is one way to think about this as indicator-based competitions. You have a series of indicators for whatever area it is you're trying to fix. You could, like the doing business ones, for example. Imagine you took the doing business indicators and attached payments to improvements in the results. And it didn't matter whether you got a contract with me or with some global fund which is doing it. If you improve, you get a payment. Simplified. Why does there have to be this series of bilateral contracts if what's important is improvement and progress? That's measured. Who would care? So those are just some thoughts. I think
Nancy's very eager to answer your question.
Yeah.
Yes, you will get a chance. That's absolutely right.
I want to focus on what's important and powerful and different about this, not the things which you happen contingently to focus on in the way you mentioned. It can be used maybe to make central governments better and to make the aid relationship better. I think it can be used to make lots of other important things better.
Just
two things. I think Laura's point about who really cares about this is worth exploring. And I find myself thinking about, I don't think governments need to be involved, but I find myself thinking about how can teachers and or even parents, how can they be part of the team? Because I think those two constituencies are the most important in getting education and learning outcomes. The second part I want to highlight that I think is terrific about this approach is it puts the outcomes of the performance out in the public domain. And for everyone to be able to discuss them, to know what's going on. And if we can do this effectively, so it's not just in some reports that's on some shelf, but it's through the media and everyone is talking about it, it can catalyze a level of public deliberation and debate and build up public pressure that can have all kinds of other pressures, with all kinds of other pressures in government that can help leverage the 90% of the other governments and donors are spending much better. And that's a missing piece right now, that reforms, because they are done behind closed doors, and because there's not a political dimension to it, they spend their bills, they don't go anywhere. And I think, for me, if COD can put in the public domain the question of our children learning, or our people's health outcomes being better, and create a public pressure to then get the governments to get the act together, I think that would be a terrific lever to get the rest of the system to work.
Just something more in this regard, Michael.
Then the central government can spend on roads. You know, if they score well on the education target, then their biggest need is roads. They can spend on roads. It makes complete sense from a standard economics point of view. But I worry that it may be that if you really want to incentivize people within the education ministry, it may be best to give it to the education ministry. Or if you want to incentivize people at the district level, the school level, you may need to take it down there. I see there's trade-offs, and I could see the case the other way. And then finally, putting this to incentivize the agents, putting this in the public domain, I think this is very helpful.
One of the things that interests me about this conversation and about this proposal is the way it seems to be spin off other things and other applications. And I think that, that's terrific, because it'll probably, if it gets implemented, may look rather different than what's in the book. So I would hope there are a lot of experiments. What I would hope doesn't happen is there's lots of talk and no experiments. So, we've heard a lot of good ideas. But in that regard, I want to share something interesting that Bill mentioned to me, which is a kind of in the realm of spinoff, and that was the notion out of the tranches, the idea that in a traditional World Bank loan, that there's a series of things you have to do, and there's, it's either happens or it doesn't. There's no sort of in-between, and the notion of making incremental payments around a commonly defined goal could be something that could be incorporated in quite a lot of lending without a massive revamp of the system. So I take that as an example of something in this that might be spun off. And I have two questions. Some of you have already talked about spin-offs, and you can choose which one you'd like to address, but then I want to open to the audience. One is there something in this that you think could be spun off into other realms that we haven't talked about? And the other one is, what do you think is the weakest part of this proposal? Where could it screw up, or where is it not fully elaborated, where hasn't it been thought through? And if you have really hot ideas on both, I'll let you do both, but you then have to do them half the time for each. So, we'd like to go for spinoffs or weak spots. Mauro.
Weak spots, I'll do a weak spot. Sure. I'm from a conservative, foundation. We're all about bottom-up things. We believe in that. I think, though, it can four countries, assuming that they're going to organize and find the best way to solve these incredibly complex policy problems with an indicator, on the basis of an indicator which actually gives you no information about how you should go about doing it. Right, so you have to improve the number of kids in school. How do we do that? They'll figure it out. Will it take 5 years? Will it take 10 years? Who knows? Does anyone in the AP even have the patience for that? The MCC, as you know, is also, Bill Kirby tries to create preconditions for ownership of the programs. It's different than a cash and delivery model, but there is a really robust consolidative process, and they're responsible, like, to pay for and responsible for the design of some of these things. What I can say is that the performance varies significantly across countries in terms of their ability to do this more than others on a timetable which is acceptable. So who pays? Who has to pay for the upfront cost for developing the stuff so that you get to the point where you're getting paid? This is, you know, for the cash on delivery central government model. I think it's a problem in the country itself.
Fisher Michael. Let me just take another weak spot as well, and because I'm a fan of COTs, so I'm going to take a weak spot. I think there's a tension between keeping the outcome very simple and measurable and getting the right outcome. And if you look at the example for education, it's about completion of schooling. And then there's this link with we will do the assessment and make the assessment public. But what we're doing now is saying the thing that really matters, which is assessment. Tagging along it when the money is going to be given for completion. I happen to think completion is not so important. I think we have plenty of people who, because of all kinds of other pressures, are completing school, or at least pretending to complete school. They may not show up, but they'll be on the roads and they'll sit for the exam. And so we will be rewarding stuff that doesn't really matter. It's also, if I think of it, who really cares about completion? It doesn't have a kind of public resonance in a way that my kid went through 7 years of school and can't even read a sentence. So I'm worried about A, that it doesn't mean we're not hitting the nail on the head, the outcome measure doesn't really matter. But second, that it doesn't have the public resonance that it might need in getting citizens to care about it. If you have a headline that says 40% of kids didn't finish school, we're so used to it, nobody worries about it. If you have a headline that says, so many kids, you know, couldn't read or write, and then you start wondering, what about my kid? Can my kid read or write? And then you get that whole, you know, mobilization. So that, I think, is a bit of a weak spot. Michael.
So I'll agree that the issue of gaming the system is a potential weak spot. I think that a good approach to doing that is that, you know, whether this turns out to be a weak spot in practice, you're only going to find out by trying it. And I think, you know, there's some, give another example of a program in Cambodia that tried to cut the contract about healthcare and assess performance against certain indicators. And these were very narrow indicators, and you worry that maybe they're stopping, they're not focusing on other indicators instead. In that particular case, it looked like there was improvement on the targeted indicators and no deterioration in the other ones. So I think this is something that you can potentially be, or can theoretically be a problem. I think it's nonetheless worth a try, and the indicators can be refined. But as far as other refined over time, if there are problems. The other weak spot of this is, unfortunately, a political one, which is, this is something that cuts out, or has the potential to cut out, but group that gets a lot of aid dollars, which is consultants, people who are in the aid business, in the aid industry. And that may generate a certain amount of resistance to this. And, you know, I think that's a reason why it's very important to do this, because it is a way of, you know, I think one of the key advantages of this is that it would get more of the money to the developing countries rather than have so much of it go on salaries in the U.S. But, you know, that's a political, that's politically, that's two ways. How to address that, I don't know, maybe starting small, you know, this wouldn't be as much of a threat.
So I want to invite the authors to rejoin the panel, and I'll give them an opportunity if they wish to respond to comments or questions that the panelists raised.
and then open it to questions and comments from the floor. I'm so surprised, Nancy, that you want to come in.
I have the advantage of my name starting with a B. But I'm sure my colleagues have things to say, too. I wanted to focus particularly on this question of incentives to whom. Mauro said you have to find the unit that cares about the results, the natural constituency. I can't tell you how many times we've heard this. The latest thing in education and in health is about incentives at the local level. School-based payments, school-based management, special arrangements for the teachers, etc. It's all true, probably, in many places. But there are two problems with it. It's an approach that could work. It's a permutation, I'm saying, cash on delivery aid that could work. But it is not the pure form that we would like to see tried. we're realistic, so maybe the permutations will come, and that would be a step in the right direction. But why doesn't it really address what I think is a fundamental issue? What we want is that the government in Malawi or Tanzania or Ghana or Papua New Guinea, after all, is having these long discussions years and years and years with all the donors that are saying what this about incentives. They're getting that information. The question is, do they own it? Do they want to try it? And when they try it, will they concentrate on learning about whether it works? So for us, the ideal arrangement is government has this deal with the funder. Head of state calls together the cabinet, says, okay, this is going to be our campaign for the next couple of years. This is why I won the election. As Rakesh said, I made this a politically salient issue. Maybe it's that children are learning. I think that was a good point about the learning. We are going to make sure, what are you going to do? And so then there's a discussion in the cabinet. Are they going to build roads? Are they going to provide better health care? Are they going to transfer more of the money directly to schools? Are they going to deal with the teachers' union? Are they going to change the deputy minister, et cetera, et cetera? In Malawi, it was the deputy minister for primary education that was the biggest fan of all of school-based management and was designing with the donors 18 different indicators of what was working at schools. When we went to visit this primary school, the idea that they were going to report on these 18 different indicators was frankly a joke. So the idea for us is that the government, the head of state, the public embrace a goal, that there's some reputational risk for the political leadership, or some reputation that's at risk, and that they go for it. Let them think it through and learn as they go along. That's what we're doing in this country. We've got Arnie Duncan with Race to the Top after 8 years of No Child Left Behind. That's part of our democratic process and part of our technocratic process as well. The only other thing I want to say is this outcome indicator would include what happens in private schools. Absolutely, it could be funded with private money, and the outcome indicator is not confined to...
Or the government could decide to issue vouchers.
The government could decide to issue vouchers. So on the political side, it could be... I sort of dream of the idea that, like microfinance, the left understands it because it's a fundamental goal about making people's lives better, and the right understands it because it's all about responsibility and accountability.
So, Bill and I, do you have anything to add before we open up the floor?
I just want to pick up on one thing that Rakesh said about putting results in the public domain.
when I was working at the Inter-American Development Bank for many years, I was struck by how many projects we put in place would be looking at the results of the previous program, and we wouldn't have any outcome indicator. We wouldn't actually know how many kids were finishing school or what the health of the program was. And that's not just a problem for IDB, it happens at other places too. One of the things that got me excited about COBA was specifically that since all the money is riding on the outcome indicator, it really concentrates the funder and the recipient on making sure they get that indicator. There's so much riding on it, you really want to get that number learned. And if you think about how many education partners have tried to get better data on primary completion, student test scores, or things like that, there isn't really an incentive to get that information. And COBA actually creates an incentive to get information in the way that most of those other programs don't. So, there's just one other thing I wanted to add.
And that ties in with the question. Then once the information is out there, it interacts in a lot of ways that are unpredictable, separate from the cash on delivery that you actually pay.
Exactly.
So it may be that what you get from it is the information rather than the outcomes.
Right.
I think you have something going on. So Heather has the microphone. I'd ask that you identify yourself and keep your questions brief. Maybe the lady here had her hand up first. Yes. Would you identify yourself, please? I was tempted to gather several questions first, but given that we come right to the core of the issue for some people in this audience, maybe I'll just take one reply on the contractors, but maybe, Nancy, do you want to say something about that? Then I do want to gather a variety of views and questions.
Just very quickly, I think it's an exaggeration to say that the donor system, you know, all the people who work in paid bureaucracies, including contractors, would be cut out. First of all, remember, in the case of Malawi, we were talking about, say, $8 million a year added to current planning there for as much as $80 million just for primary education a year. So what we're hoping is that the government would ask for help and would obviously ask for help from those who are there, the donors that are involved there, private and public. I think the idea of issuing a contract to the contractors needs to be thought through. You never know. You know, if the government wanted to do that, great.
The recipient government or the donor government?
The recipient government. The recipient government might hire Chemonix or McKinsey to take care of it, get on with it.
Okay. Let's get a few more views. Maybe the lady here and then the gentleman up here. Yep. Yes, Heather. Thank you.
And I spent 2 years in one part of the 5-year evaluation for Global Fund, where we looked at partnership and trade ownership and the new business model of the favorite commerce company. I hear some similarities in the synopsis that you've given with COBA. I hear some big differences. And the way it played out was quite interesting. I think contractors worked that government did opt to buy contractors and consultants to design the production kitchen. They didn't take ownership. I mean, and the views on that was very different. Whether the country had a view that that was a good way to own it, or whether it took the realm of the country. I think the patience issue was something that we really identified. The 5-year viewpoint versus the quarterly reporting that is changing, but at that time was required, which really distorted what the recipients then actually focused on. And in health, as it sounds like also in education, the key is the information. Targets were set without any baselines. We don't have outcome indicators for a lot of things because things like mortality rates are really expensive. Sure that health impact information was actually going to be available at the time when it needed to be measured for the next round of funding to be given. So now that's, you know, a lot of that is being addressed, but I think that might be a big key to a new model for delivering development aid to kind of be off well and not run into some of the problems that the experiment with public funds actually has and then has had to correct.
Thanks very much. And I should say, comments are very much welcome, and they need to always be phrased as a question. I know that's great. Do keep them brief, but I think that those are some very interesting comments and be very helpful to those who are working on this. I said the gentleman here, and then take the gentleman way in the back, and we'll take those that round.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Neil Scott from PSI. My question is, what you said, cash delivery, the new approach to coordinate. Now, what you said sounds very similar to what we've been discussing. You mentioned yourself, conditional cash transfer, results-based financing, performance-based financing. Even budget support is not a blank check written out to a government, regardless of its performance. It's linked to a set of indicators, and primary school enrollment is many times one of them. What do you think is really the new thing about cash and delivery, or is it just more of a new name for something that has been existing already for some time?
Great question. What's new here? The gentleman in the back.
My name is Fernando Salah from Tanzania University. I'd like to thank Nancy. We were together in Doha, Qatar, when this concept was mentioned the last time with my president, Bill Clinton. And then my government, the UNIA, would be one of the first countries to adopt this concept. It's not a question, but the panelists have spoken about various models of donor. We have like American government with the MCC, for example. Tanzania being one of the beneficiaries, we really appreciate the U.S. government for that because there's an element of ownership. Right now, a number of projects have been undertaken in a transparent manner. And the government is looking forward to further cooperation with the U.S. government, and that has consolidated our relationship with the United States. Regarding this concept of COD, Madam Nancy, she indicated the component of incentives. I do remember, I'm from Zanzibar, Tanzania. The whole class used to pass. What of the reason behind this? Because there were incentives. Teachers were, they were comfortable with everyone. There was no complaints. But there was a decline slowly from late 70s, 80s. The further we go to 2000, you can see the graph going down. So at the end of the day, we have to establish what the root cause. So my colleague just now, you mentioned about, is it something new or is it the same also with a different public policy?
To get a couple more questions because it seems like we've had this interesting comments, but not so much for the panel to respond to. I don't know, Heather, if you can get way over there to Phil and maybe the gentleman behind him. Thanks very much, gentlemen behind Phil.
recent evaluation assessment in Malawi, separately about the details of that, but relative to this discussion, Malawi is exceptionally aid dependent, and it's not clear at all where the money would come from to implement any major new initiative without some cash up front. My question is, I don't really understand, so we can work out all the details about trust and accountability and the rest of that. How the funding mechanism work? Why would a minister of education in some country believe that promises of funding 5 years out can actually be there? And that's a longer than the political cycle, the budget cycle, the appropriation cycle, and the history of funding ups and downs.
Okay, so we had a question going in reverse order about the credibility of commitments, thresholds, and a couple of people saying what's new here. There are probably some others I missed. Nancy, do you want to? I think they're pretty much directed at the authors, Nancy and Bourbille. Yes, if you have any comment from your colleague at the embassy.
Example, Gavi, the Global Alliance for the Vaccine Initiative, is one of the closest things we found to a COVID agreement. The government's large portion of the funding that's money for child immunized. One of the ways this differs is the way we've looked at verification. Gavi just assessed whether the government's reporting system was of good quality or not. And in some cases, that seems to work. In other cases, there's indications that there was misreporting. And we have a very different and more rigorous approach to verification. And I thought I'd address this question that Phil put out there about why no threshold. And part of that was this notion that when you have a pass-fail kind of tranche condition, it creates high stakes and it forces the recipients and the funders to go into this phase of negotiation. I jokingly called it tranche warfare once. It isn't helpful. And by contrast, when you don't have a threshold, instead of thinking of we succeeded or we failed, you have a completely different mindset where it's we were less successful or we were more successful. And so there's a whole series of reasons that even if no one adopts any of the COD evidence, I think getting this kind of continuous indicator in practice would be a really interesting step forward.
I was just on this last point that Bill made. One of the reasons that I think we found it appealing is the history on structural adjustment lending and even budget support, where it's very difficult for the official donors in particular to exit when there's a problem. With budget support, so many indicators. Another thing is the citizens don't get it, so they don't understand at all. So you have the problem sometimes that citizens are saying, why are the British or why are the Germans lining the pockets of our government. You know, why? That's why the MCC in Tanzania is so interesting and important, because there's transparency about the way the system is working. But this issue of exit is very tough for the funders, because it's very politically hard to leave when key indicators aren't met. And in fact, the history is that donors didn't leave. So one of the issues here is the CODA creates an incentive that's actually kind of viable, it's meaningful, it's tractable for both sides. The other thing I wanted to say, when there was a discussion about bringing in outsiders, does a government really own a program when it brings in outsiders to design and implement it? I just thought back to the days of Botswana, its early independence, and Korea also. These are countries that where aid worked, and I think there's a general consensus amongst those who studied these programs that one of the reasons they worked is that it was the decision of officials and of the leadership, the political leadership, to bring in experts actually sitting in the ministries of finance, but they were working for that political leadership. They weren't working there because some donor thought there ought to be a consultant guiding the minister or another official on a particular issue.
Okay, did you have if I answered that again, this is saying that Rwanda today is also a case where if you look at how the Rwanda government is run with clear leadership, that there's lots of people from within East Africa and beyond that. One other point also about budget support now is that the classic problem right now is that the donors are also the referees. And this is a problem because if they are judging whether performance is not good enough, there's incentive to fudge. What COD does is makes the referee somebody else. On Tanzania, you asked the question, why were we doing so well in the 60s, 70s, and Mozambique? I think one is as a result of the expansion. If you're only educating 10, 20%, which we worry, I think less than 15% in the 60s and early 70s. You can do much more than if you're trying to educate everybody. And then we had, as you know, an economic crisis in the 70s after the war with Amin in Uganda, so that financial resources were drained. And I think we never quite recovered from that. And one of the legacies we've had of that is a situation where the accountability function broke down, and we never, even as we put more money in, that hasn't come back. So just getting the accountability and the teacher motivation functions to work is, I think, going to be key to getting this right.
I think we'll take one more round. Are you indicating there was somebody there? Yes. Okay.
Yes.
Yes, I've seen those folks there. So let's do these people here, if you can keep them real brief, and then we'll have about two over here.
Hello, I'm Aubrey Rudy. My question is short and goes back to one of Mauro's points on the political kind of viability of this model, especially here in the U.S. I'm just like, you're the author's view of it. I agree, very similar to Mauro's point. I can imagine, especially in health, we have some very strong views in Congress on how money should not be spent in health around maternal health. You're looking at kind of maternal health indicators, making sure that there's not money spent on abortion services, you know, these kind of things. It seems that a lot of donors have cares and constituencies around prescriptive ways money can be spent or should be spent. So just a response to how viable that is on a government-to-government bilateral level.
Thanks very much. Who else have a hand up here? Yes, sir.
My name is Peter Panaka from the Museum of Biology. I would have loved to have this presentation in Europe. I think it would be well received. But one of the things maybe which should be stressed more, I think, in the whole aspect of complementarity, this complementarity and other things that might be more easy to sample than some of the questions, were in the sense that how do you front load and what do I report? Because how do you see to it that the Ministry of Education, they have plan established, they have the right capacity, etc., etc. You have to put it into the government. Yes, but it's
much. I believe there was one more hand back here.
Placing full discretion in the recipient and actually at the household level. And what that research seems to be telling us is that if you choose the unit correctly, that is, in words, you use the unit that carries the most outcomes, in this case, the household level, maybe you don't need contingencies or incentives. And I'm wondering to what extent.
Thanks very much, Chris. Heather, we've got two hands over here.
Hi, thanks very much. Rebecca Lindberg from the Center for Reimbursement Education at Brookings. I have a question for the authors, two questions actually. The first question is just to hear a little bit more from you. Do you have an idea in your mind that this of a certain type of country in which this model will work, or a certain type of aid, you know, you have to have a relatively independent media, some civil society, you know, a government, a cohesive government, you know, that type of thing. Is it needed humanitarian aid or just development aid? So you probably have thought through that, but would it be really interesting to hear from you as a kind of subset of the developing world or type of development aid we're talking about? That's the first question. And then the second question is something that I was really intrigued about by the model, which has to do with this hot topic of technical assistance. And to me, technical assistance per se is not the problem. The problem is technical assistance fobbed onto a country by a donor who's forcing them to take it. You know, it would be really nice to have competition amongst technical assistance countries with you know, hey, you consultant, you know, we'll thank technical assistance, but anybody, you know, who fire you and hire someone else. So I think that would be a great, you know, contribution or something, and have you thought through that and work out with that work? So those are my two questions, and just ultimately to say, you know, congratulations. I think, to me, the strongest sort of point you have going for trying this is the counterfactual, you know, well, what else are we going to do? Same thing over and over. So congratulations and kudos to you guys for doing that.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have given you the last word. that's all right.
Well, thank you. I'm John Pendergast. I'm senior fellow at Brookings. It's not the book because the price is not correct. I can upload those to myself. Thank you for inviting me to the presentation. I have two quick questions, but one because there has been a gentleman from your vision. I don't see the connection very closely between the progressive program and this particular program, because the progressive program is the invasion of a dozen, maybe 3 dozen years of micro research that understands why parents, poor parents, do not send their kids to school. It's not because they're stupid or they don't want to do it. They may not have all the information that given them to move in the right direction. Their credit constraints, the school may not be great or safe, they may need the income from their children. They're all kind of stuff that you can accommodate by those conditional cash conditions. So we understand the constraints from all that micro research, but I don't understand the constraints from at the political level. If the Minister of Education doesn't want the kids to learn, why are we even talking to the guy? So it's not, he may not have the money to send the kids to school and have enough teachers in school, so you can do that, but to entice him to have kids to learn, I don't understand what constraint other than his stubbornness or his uninterestedness we're trying to accommodate. The more fundamental
has is that I think Bill misspoke when he said, "I'm going to pay them for each additional kid that goes to school or actually learns." I think you're probably going to each additional kid that is going to school because of this particular program. So, there's this entire development where the center has been very instrumental, that we want to know whether the development aid works, and so we have to do experiments. We have to, and that means we have to answer the question, what is the counterfactual? So my question here is, how do you deal, especially if you go into interesting outcomes like learning instead of enrolling, how do you deal with the counterfactual? How do you reward politicians or whoever you want to reward for the additional kit that is learning that would not have been learning in the absence of the program?
Thanks very much. I know that the authors have been taking good notes rather than spend time trying to briefly summarize those. I'll let you choose the part that interests you most, and this will be your closing words. Maybe I'll let the panel go first. The panelists want to say anything before the authors, so this would be your opportunity. No? Nancy, so it's over to you how you want to organize your final remarks with your co-authors.
These are all fabulous questions. I think some of them are answered in the book, but others are part of our continuing, working out the idea in different sectors. I'll try to make one quick one on the issue about technical assistance. I do think that this addresses the issue because the money is no longer linked to you're getting a grant from us or a loan from us, therefore you have to use the consultants that we approve. So the government really, as in these cases that were mentioned, books one or the longer stuff, have much more autonomy to decide who they're going to hire and if they're going to hire and what terms. So that's a very clear, easy answer. We have thought about different kinds of countries and stuff in terms of civil society. We only speculated on what conditions in which it's likely to be more successful, not that this would be an eligibility condition. And some speculation about why it might work better in a high-capacity country is they can do stuff. On the other hand, they might have bureaucratic institutions that are more rigid in a more low capacity, low institution developed context might have more freedom to negotiate with its domestic constituencies and stuff. So the book talks a little bit about some of those concerns. And I think that the last point I want to make was just this bigger issue about one. I think Jacques' point about with conditional cash transfers, we have models of household behavior. We don't have a very good model of how governments are going to respond to something like this. And I don't think we ever will have it. We have fewer observations, and they're much more complex. And that's where the idea of experimenting with it comes in. Give it a try and see. And there was actually a chapter explicitly on how to do the research to see how it's going. So pay attention. I think it's chapter 6. But I do want to say that people have talked about this idea of giving dollars to the unit that cares the most. But another way of looking at it is giving dollars to a unit that really hasn't been engaged in the process yet.
And are promising dollars if they achieve something.
Well, yeah, I'm thinking particularly like we were skimming to one education specialist who just negotiated a sector-wide approach in a particular country. And we said, well, do you think this would work? And they said, oh, well, we've got the plans, we've got the strategy, we don't need anything else, we're gonna do this. And after we talked to them about it, we said, but wait a minute, what could go wrong? And then she said, oh, well, you know, the finance ministry doesn't disperse the money on time. Well, maybe if the finance ministry knew it could get $200 of extra foreign exchange and so forth, they would solve another problem. So one other thing is dollars going to units that haven't really been engaged yet. And that's, again, it's a hypothesis. It's not a moment.
Nancy, final word.
So I'm going to try to raise and respond to a number of things. First, I want to say, why a contract, which came up earlier? You know, I think it's a great question, but maybe in our minds, the contract is really to lock in the funder, not to lock in the recipient. And this also goes to the issue of the 5 years. I want to be clear that we're talking about payments each year. It's not only at the end of 5 years. I'm not sure there was a misunderstanding about that. But really, countries that receive aid have, there's a great work of Moni Karas, who's right now in Oxford talking about this sort of thing, showing how unpredictable and volatile at the country level the expectation, the reality is in terms of recipients from outside. And that matters a lot in countries where 50% of their budget is covered by from outside. Political liability in the U.S. You know, there are these surveys that are done in the U.S. about foreign aid. And what they suggest is that what citizens, taxpayers in this country care about most is good things happening to people in poor countries, reducing infant mortality, getting children through school. That always education and health come up at the top. And I think this response to, say, the Haiti earthquake is in the same strain. You know, it's this humanitarian impulse. It's a lot about compassion for people. So I believe that if we could show that this approach worked, eventually our legislators in the Congress would also get the message from citizens. We want our aid to be delivering good outcomes for people abroad. And that this, that's part of what could be the message in a COD-like arrangement. Complimentary, yes, I loved hearing that. Again, we learned as we went along in talking about this that it really makes most sense if it's complementary to all the other input-based aid that's going on, and that, in fact, it might trigger much more efficient use of all the other money by having this particular incentive added to it. The cash transfers, I think that's something that we should be thinking about more at the center because, and we actually have a colleague who did a great op-ed on how you could take all the Indian programs that are meant to deal with household issues and take all the money and it would amount to, 10% of the annual income of the poorest households, which would be a lot. And that would be a much more efficient way to deliver the goods. But this COD aid is really about as much dealing with the donor system, the funder system, as trying to lock the donors in, help them make their own trap, tie their hands behind their backs on the issues that they've resolved to address. So cash transfers don't address that particular problem, although I think it's an important issue. What type of country? It's a great question. We've thought about it mostly in the context of low-income countries that are dependent on aid. But I don't want to say, and we discuss this in the book, that leaves out fragile states that have relatively weak governments. I like to use the example of Liberia, that has very responsible leadership, but not really rich yet capacity at the mid-level, at the middle level and below. It's a country that's working out how to decentralize certain services. It seems to me that there are possibilities in a place like Liberia to do exactly this kind of approach, which might actually be easier for donors to do than input-based aid, where they have to monitor for fear of waste, for fear of corruption, all the disbursements and all of the arrangements. The market for technical assistance is a great idea. We have that very much in our mind, that this would help generate a real market for technical assistance. And I want to say to Jacques that we explicitly discuss in the book the fact that with this approach, we don't care about attribution. And in fact, there's a book coming out edited by Bill Easterly and Jessica Cohn. It's a Brookings book, Honors to Brookings, in which I discuss this point in response to the paper presented by, I think it was Lance Pritchett, that you have different kinds of evaluation, and we emphasize attribution at the micro level, but we're talking in Chapter 5 of this book about different kind of evaluation that would help address issues that have to be thought through in terms of the political model and how, in a particular country, the politics as well as the policy responds to a different incentive.
Nancy, thank you very much. We have a policy when we launch what we think is an important idea and you care enough to show up, we give you a copy of the book. There's an implicit contract here. You take it away and read it. I think you'll find it eminently readable. And we also provide lots of opportunities for ongoing discussion on the website. Both Nancy and I, and also Bill, routinely blog about these issues online. There's a comment field. I would encourage all of you to follow that and contribute your wisdom and views online. I'd like to thank our panelists and our authors, and thank you all for joining us.